Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second season of The History of Modern Greece, where we cover the subject of the fall of Constantinople to the modern day. I'm your host, Daniel Roberts, and I'm here with my father, George.
Hi, my name's George.
And our music is brought to you by Mark Youngerman. This is episode 46, The Byzantine Golden Age, Basil the First. Last time in our narrative, we covered the fall of Empress Irene. We discussed how the finance minister overthrew her and became Emperor Nikephoros of the Eastern Roman Empire. He then led a campaign against the newly formed Bulgarian Empire and managed to get himself turned into a drinking cup. After the short reign of his son, Stauracios died of gangrene. He had been mortally wounded in the same battle that killed his father. Stauracios' brother-in-law rose to the position of emperor and immediately tried fixing things within the empire. He opened relations with Charlemagne in the west by acknowledging his position as emperor in the west. He didn't go as far as saying he recognized him as emperor of all the Romans. This was meeting him halfway, which was a good place to meet, considering their empires shared a border.
Under the influence of a very influential monk named Theodore, Emperor Michael neglected the peace terms with the Khan Krum of Bulgaria and began incursions. And initially, they were very successful, so he totally betrayed him, which was quite silly considering both of the last two emperors died fighting the Bulgars. But in 813 CE, at Vercingetorix near Adrianople, they were defeated. While this happened, the senior general Leo the Armenian fled the battle. Michael realized conspiracy was afoot, so he abdicated the throne in July of 813 CE in favor of Leo. This move most likely saved him from assassination. Michael became a monk, and to end his line and ensure there was no threat to Emperor Leo, he and all of his sons were castrated and relegated to monasteries. That is what I call devotion to your new boss. Also, ouch. That would have been a very interesting conversation to listen to while Emperor Michael sat down with his boys and convinced them to cut off their balls. I'm sure it wasn't like going into surgery today. They probably did it while they were awake. Interestingly, one of his sons, Nicetas, renamed Ignatios, became the Patriarch of Constantinople. In June of 813 CE, Leo became the emperor. In a diplomatic move, he wrote a letter to the Patriarch to reassure him that he was not an iconoclast.
In 814 CE, Khan Krum of the Bulgars died, and Leo immediately went on the offensive, defeating them in several key battles. In 815 CE, both the Romans and the Bulgars were exhausted from fighting and signed a peace treaty. A curious note about the ceremony for this treaty: it was a solemn event performed in front of many witnesses. Emperor Leo had to do things according to pagan custom, such as pouring water from a cup onto the ground, personally turning a horse saddle around, and lifting grass above the ground. Seems simple enough, and you might even be wondering, who cares? That doesn't seem like a big deal to anyone, but that was a big deal. These actions apparently horrified Christian historians who witnessed the ceremony. It was total blasphemy for the emperor of the Christian Empire to partake in pagan customs. Then, the ruler of Bulgaria, Khan Omertog, did things according to Christian customs. It seems symbolic of the treaty itself. Each leader had to perform out of their comfort zone, not particularly enjoying it. The treaty itself was similar. Each empire had to give up land that they didn't want to, and exchange prisoners of war that they were using as slaves. The treaty did favor Bulgaria, but but the Byzantines were okay with it because they'd lost so many battles that they needed time to regroup. Also, they had more internal trouble with the revival of iconoclasm. But at the same time, Bulgaria was having religious problems of its own. Christianity was spreading throughout the empire, and this disturbed Khan Omertog. So he started the persecutions. Now, a quick fun fact. Ironically, the first Christian martyr in Bulgaria was Omertog's eldest son, Enrivato, who was condemned to death by his younger brother, who was the Khan in 833. Enrivato became the first Bulgarian saint.
Leo's predecessors were all iconophiles, and they were all associated with losing against the Bulgars and Arabs. Leo didn't want to be associated with them at all, so he reinstituted the practice of iconoclasm and quickly deposed the patriarch for being an iconophile. After this move, Leo was able to gain financially by seizing the properties of iconophiles and monasteries. So this move wasn't just made out of superstition. There was a financial motive at play, and there always is. Leo appointed competent military commanders from those among his closest friends, including Michael the Armenian and Thomas the Slav. Yet, Leo became suspicious and paranoid about Michael and had him jailed for suspicion of conspiracy. While in jail, Michael and his co-conspirators arranged to assassinate Emperor Leo. So either Michael was conspiring to kill the emperor, or being wrongfully accused made him angry and wanted to conspire against the emperor. And so, in 820 CE, on Christmas Eve, in the chapel of St. Stephen, Emperor Leo sat to watch the service. Like a scene from a movie, assassins disguised as monks snuck up behind the emperor, then threw off their robes and attacked. They stabbed and stabbed the man in front of them, only to realize they mistook the high priest for the emperor. In the chaos, Emperor Leo grabbed a metal crucifix and defended himself against the assailants. He fought valiantly but was outnumbered, and the assassins cut him to pieces in front of everyone watching the Christmas Eve ceremony. The assassins quickly ran to the dungeon and had Michael crowned emperor. Humorously, because they couldn't find the key, Michael was crowned emperor while in his shackles.
Leo's family were exiled to monasteries. And to repeat the dreadful act performed on the previous emperor, Leo's four sons were castrated. The act was so severe that one of his sons died of the injuries. Immediately after being crowned, Michael II faced a revolt by Thomas the Slav, which quickly grew into a full-scale civil war that lasted an entire 4 years. Thomas the Slav was an army officer of Slavic origin, which is obvious, as his name suggests. What would be really strange was if Thomas the Slav was actually an Isaurian. Thomas came from northern Anatolia and had served under the great general Doukas. Once Leo was crowned emperor, Thomas became the senior general in Anatolia. After Leo the Armenian was murdered by Michael II, Thomas decided to revolt to take the throne for himself. He had just as much claim to the throne as Michael, so why not take it for himself? At first, the civil war started out well for Thomas. But while he was laying siege to Constantinople, Khan Omertog of Bulgaria rode his cavalry south and attacked from the rear, breaking up the siege. Thomas's small contingent was nothing compared to the great Bulgarian army, and so the army surrendered conditionally. That condition being the soldiers hand over Thomas the Slav and everyone gets to go home. Now that was a really tough decision for Thomas the Slav to make. But it wasn't tough for the army at all. So they immediately handed over Thomas, who was executed. This is kind of reminiscent of the Great Siege of 717, when the massive Arab army was attacked from the rear by the Bulgar army. For some reason, this keeps happening, and for some reason, the Romans keep angering the people who always come to the rescue. There has been a lot of discussion as to the motives Thomas the Slav would have had for revolting against Michael II. The first, well, he was an iconoclast. The second, well, this was a social uprising by non-Greek citizens. The third was to avenge the death of his friend Leo the Armenian. And the fourth was just personal ambition. Maybe it was all four. Just like Leo the Armenian, Michael II was an iconoclast. And because of this hatred and desecration of religious icons, relations between the Pope in the West and the Patriarch in the East deteriorated even further.
During Michael's reign, there were two major losses on the battlefield: the beginning of the Muslim conquest of Sicily and the loss of Crete to the Saracens. The Islamic conquest of Sicily began in 827 CE, while the final Byzantine stronghold fell in 902 CE. In 829 CE, Michael II died and was succeeded by his son, Theophilus. Just like his father before him, Theophilus was an iconoclast. The whole strategy of his iconoclasm was to weaken the strength of the Greek Orthodox Church and monasteries. He was literally seizing all of their wealth. It would be the equivalent of draining someone's bank account. But Theophilus went even further and prosecuted anyone who wasn't an iconoclast. Even though Theophilus was in a constant state of war with the Arabs on his eastern frontier, he was highly influenced by the wise courts of Baghdad. He emulated Harun al-Rashid by wandering about the capital, informally listening to the complaints of his subjects. Theophilus constructed fortresses, which anchored Byzantine northern defenses against raiders coming from the rivers. He also strengthened his defenses along the eastern and western frontiers to protect against Arab raiders. In 838 CE, Theophilus ran into trouble with a new caliph, Al-Mutasim. The Arabs raided into Anatolia and struck the most important centers on the route to Constantinople. First Emperor Theophilus was defeated at the Battle of Dazimon. Then he was defeated at Ancyra. And then a month later, the great city of Amorium was besieged and finally fell. This was a particularly harsh defeat for the emperor, as Amorium was the home of his dynasty. In 841 CE, dissension started to grow amongst the Arabs, which Emperor Theophilus was able to exploit. Using the help of the Spanish Moors, who were still Umayyads, they captured the city of Melitene on the Armenian border, forcing the Abbasid Caliph to sign a truce. This wasn't the first time Byzantines would ally themselves with one group of Muslims against the other.
In 842 CE, Emperor Theophilus died and was succeeded by his son Michael III. But because he was only 2 years old, his mother, Theodora, was his regency. And helping her was her uncle Sergius, as well as the minister Theoctetos. Theoctetos was a leading diplomat who had helped Michael II seize the throne over 20 years before, so he helped out the regency until 855 when he was suddenly dismissed, then murdered. Stay tuned. Interestingly, while Emperor Theophilus was an iconoclast, his wife, Theodora, was not. She obviously kept this secret very well because she managed to make it this far without being persecuted. And you can bet yourself that she would have never been put in a position had people known she was an iconophile. One source says she kept her icons hidden in her private chamber. And one day, a servant caught her praying with her icons and reported her to the emperor. When he confronted her about the incident, she simply said, "I was playing with my dolls." Now this makes me wonder, how many poor people got caught playing with their dolls and were mistakenly persecuted for being an iconophile? Also, who the hell plays with dolls at that age? Two of her icons still survive today and are on display at a monastery at Vatopedi on Mount Athos. While she was a regent, she was able to end iconoclasm, which is a pretty big deal, and a sign of stability returning to the empire. No one wants an angry mob running around smashing artwork to pieces. Well, that's not entirely true, because we know for a fact that is exactly what the iconoclasts did. But no reasonable person wanted that. She was also able to replenish the treasury, and generally, she governed pretty well. Just because she ended iconoclasm, though, doesn't mean there weren't any religious persecutions. The Pelagian sect of Christianity was heavily persecuted under her regency.
What is a Pelagian sect of Christianity, you may ask? Well, I'll give you a very brief description from the internet. They are a dualist medieval sect of Christianity. Dualist means they believed in good versus evil. It seems as though they were not Trinitarian, which is the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, but also they didn't recognize the authority of the patriarch. They completely rejected the Old Testament as well as the worship of Mary, the Mother of God. They believed that Jesus came down from heaven to teach man how to shed their sinful physical bodies and obtain entry into the spiritual realm of heaven. To them, everything physical was sin, but the soul was worth redeeming. So they ate to survive, but not for enjoyment. They procreated, but didn't have sex or fun. It is proposed, but not confirmed, that they were influenced by a Persian prophet named Mani, who founded the Manichaean religion, and later scholars attributed the Pelagian sect of Christianity to early Christianity, before the popes and patriarchs became government bodies in the empire. So, to make a long story short, they were Christians. But they were the wrong type of Christians. And if you thought the divide between Protestant and Catholic was big, this was a much bigger divide. Catholics and Protestants are like Coke and Pepsi, and the Pelagian sect of Christianity was all of juice.
Back to the narrative. Theodora was so busy being regent and making sure the empire functioned smoothly that she neglected the education of her son Michael. This left the window open for someone else to gain his influence. Theodora's brother, Bartus, slowly gained the influence of his nephew. It's really important to stress the fact that Theodora neglected educating her son because she was working so hard. It's under Theodora that the Byzantine Empire started to recover. Her hard work may not have protected her in the short run, but it definitely strengthened the empire. In 855 CE, Theodora realized her brother had corrupted her son's influence, but it was too late. She tried to stop her brother, but there was nothing she could do. Michael III, under the influence of his uncle Bartus, dismissed his mother as regent and condemned her to a life in the monastery, along with all of his sisters. He even dismissed his advisor Theoctetos and had him murdered. In 857, Michael III was officially crowned as the Roman Emperor. Spoiler alert, he was the last member of the Amorium dynasty. He was also given the epitaph of the Drunkard, which illustrates his reign quite well. The smear against Michael's character was most likely added by the later historians who were paid to smear him by order of the next dynasty. And modern historians tend to view Michael III in a much more favorable light. After all, it is because of the actions taken by Michael III that the empire steered into a new Byzantine Golden Age.
Up north, the Bulgarian Empire was at war with the Franks and the Croatians, and this moment of instability was taken advantage of by the Byzantines. And they invaded, winning several key battles against the Bulgars. Michael ended up taking several key ports along the Black Sea. Between the years 856 and 863 CE, Michael III was at constant war with the Apusids. In 859 CE, Michael personally led a siege against the city of Samosata along the Euphrates River. However, a year later, he received a message that a barbarian tribe known as the Rus were attacking Constantinople. He was forced to call off the siege against the Samosata and return to the capital. In 863 CE, Michael's other uncle and general Petronius defeated the Arab army and killed the emir of Melitene. Spreading the Byzantine Christian faith under the guidance of Patriarch Photius, Michael sponsored missionaries to the Khazar Khaganate, which spread across the Eurasian steppe, north of the Black and Caspian Sea. This missionary mission wasn't just to spread the influence of Greek Orthodoxy, but was also meant to stop the rapid spreading of Judaism within the Khazar Empire. Khazars are a Turkic nomadic people who traditionally worship the sky god Tengri, but for some reason, Judaism was spreading rapidly among their tribes. This was a direct threat to the patriarch's control and influence and needed to be stopped. Needless to say, these missionaries failed in their mission.
So now there is a Jewish Turkic Khanate threatening the Greek Byzantine Empire. This is an interesting beginning to our second season, especially when you consider how the season is going to end. Just because the missionaries didn't do well in the Khazar Khaganate doesn't mean they weren't successful in other places. They managed to get many converts in Great Moravia, which was a large Slavic state in Central Europe. The motive here was to get the jump on Roman Catholicism. While on mission in Central Europe, the missionaries Cyril and Methodius, who were also brothers, devised the Glagolitic alphabet, which made it possible for the Slavs to read in their own language. We know from previous episodes how important it is to read and write. Fearing the potential conversion of Boris I of Bulgaria to Christianity under the Frankish influence, Emperor Michael and his uncle Bardas invaded Bulgaria in 864 CE. Part of the peace treaty was that Boris had to convert to Greek Orthodoxy under the influence of the Patriarch in Constantinople. Despite the bad press Michael III got from his successor, many positive things happened during Michael's reign. The economy was finally stabilized, and by the year 850, the empire's revenue had increased considerably. The end of iconoclasm early in his reign led to a renaissance in visual arts. The empire made considerable advances in organization and religious cohesion, and the empire held its ground against the caliphate, and most significantly, Bulgaria became a religious and cultural satellite of the Byzantine Empire. Even though Michael was the emperor, much credit has to go to his mother, Theodora, and Theoctetos, and even his uncle Bardas and Petronius.
Around the year 850 CE, a young man moved to Constantinople to seek his fame and fortune. This young man's name was Basil. He was only 20 years old at the time, but had already lived an exciting life. For Basil and his entire family had just escaped slavery. Basil was so poor when he first arrived in Constantinople that he actually slept on the streets. I'm sure thousands of others arrived in the capital city under the exact same circumstances, but Basil was very smart and had a certain charm about him. His first job within the capital was working as a stable boy or stable young man. It just so happened that the owner of this stable was a relative of Emperor Michael III, so luck kind of had something to do with his rise to power. He managed to get himself tangled up in a romantic relationship with a family member of the owner of the stable. It's unsure if this was a coerced relationship or not, but it shows he was somewhat attractive to others. While he was in town, he caught the attention of another wealthy noble woman. This time, it was the mega-rich widow Danielius. She wasn't just rich, but very well-connected. Somehow, whether through charm or wit or just because she really liked him, the widow Danielius adopted the young Basil into her family. She welcomed him into her home and set Basil up with her money and resources. A true story of rags to riches. Basil was also very athletic and competed in wrestling. He was so good that the Byzantines set him up with a Bulgarian wrestling champion, and Basil kicked his ass. This was a huge win for Basil's fame and prestige. Everyone in the capital now knew who he was. One of Basil's biggest fans was watching him that day from a balcony high above the common stands. It was a young Michael III, who was only a teenager at the time. Michael grew very fond of Basil and eventually invited him into his court. While serving in his court, Basil and Michael grew very close. Life was good for Basil. He started out as a slave, then moved to the capital, inherited a ton of money, competed in and won in the wrestling championship, and was now hanging out with a Roman emperor.
Only someone with a lot of ambition could have risen that fast. And he seemed to have caught the attention of Emperor Michael's advisor, Uncle Bardas. Bardas grew suspicious of Basil and questioned his motives, and even went as far as harassing the young Macedonian. He could tell that Basil had climbed far too fast and high and wouldn't stop until he was at the very top. So Basil, with his charm, went to Michael and told him that Uncle Bardas was harassing him and threatening him. Well, Michael III wasn't going to let his uncle bully his new best friend around, so he charged his Uncle Bardas with treason and allowed Basil to personally execute him. There must have been a moment where Basil looked at Bardas in the eye and smirked. To solidify Basil's position in Michael's court, the emperor told Basil to divorce his current wife and to remarry Michael's ex-mistress. This would legally bind him to the noble family. And this young woman's name was Eudokia. Now, just when things couldn't possibly get any better for Basil, Michael III named him Caesar and co-emperor of the Roman Empire. Having watched a little Big Brother in my day, I know how the best players advance. They always plant an idea in someone's head to make it seem like it was their idea all along. I can just imagine Basil planting all these seeds in Michael's head. What did he say? What did he do that convinced Michael to name him co-emperor of the empire? We'll probably never know. But this does beg the question. Why has no one made a movie of this guy? And if they have, would someone please tell me where to find it?
On May 26, 866 CE, Basil was crowned as Caesar of the Empire and became the second most powerful man in the Greek world. It seemed as though once Basil climbed this high, Michael started to grow bored with his new Caesar. There is a very interesting tidbit of information here. Basil married Eudokia, who is Michael's ex-mistress, and Eudokia had a child. It is believed by many that Eudokia's child was actually Michael's. And by marrying his friend to this mistress, then promoting Basil to Caesar, he is legitimizing his bastard son's claim to the throne. Well, if that was the case, Michael lost all interest in Basil once he was crowned co-emperor and actually started to fancy another young man named Basil Licinia. Basil noticed this right away if the emperor was getting sick of him and started to admire another young man with a very similar name, it only meant that he was one impulsive decision away from being replaced permanently. Basil had to act in order to save himself.
On the night of September 23rd, 867 CE, Basil and his close friends and family snuck into the royal palace. There was a banquet that night, and Michael III and Basil Ascinia stumbled back to the royal chambers drunk. Conveniently, the lock on the Emperor Michael's door was broken, and the guards were away from their post. Basil and his brother, cousin, and father easily picked the lock and opened the door. They caught Michael III and Basil Ascinia in bed, and the group ran up with daggers and stabbed the two men to death in the royal bed. One of the assailants is said to have chopped off both of Michael's arms as he struggled on the bed, bleeding all over the sheets, screaming for his guards to come to his rescue. But they never came. Finally, a sword was plunged into the emperor's belly, spilling his guts. Because Basil was raised to the position of Caesar publicly, he automatically became the next emperor of the Roman Empire.
What's to be learned here?
It's funny to think that if the Vice President of the United States ever murdered the President in his bed, the last thing the country would do is make that man President. He'd most likely be arrested that day. But not in the Roman Empire. This was just a way of self-promotion.
Sorry, I thought you were done. I didn't mean to cut it, but you can edit it.
Oh, that's fine. I'll just...
That was fucking great.
The conversion of the Bulgars has been evaluated as one of the greatest cultural and political achievements of the Byzantine Empire. Basil's reign was so unique in many ways that novels have been written about his life. And if you would like to learn about him, the series is called The Tale of Crispos. The author's name is Harry Turtledove. This is a fictional story about the real-life Basil and his rise to power. Even though the names are changed, it is still his story.
Well, that's it for today. Join us next time on the history of modern Greece. Stay safe and stay awesome.